stories don't define you. How you tell them will. Hi, I'm Sarah Elkins, your host and chief story maker of Elkins Consulting.
When we share stories, whether in our personal or business lives, how we share them makes a difference in how we remember them and in how we're perceived by the people we're sharing them with. When you're listening to this podcast, I encourage you to listen and consider your own related stories. To listen and think about which stories in your life might have impacted you in a similar way. And think about how you share those stories and the messages they carry for you and for the people who are hearing them. So my friend Robert Downs, a photographer out in LA, gave me an introduction to Kenny Aronoff a couple weeks ago, and I reached out to him and he agreed to be on the podcast, Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will. And I'm so grateful both to Robert and to Kenny for this great opportunity. So thanks for joining me, Kenny.
You're absolutely welcome.
So usually what I do to start my podcast is I ask my guests to tell the audience something that most people don't know about them, something that wouldn't be on their bio or their resume. And maybe people who knew them from their childhood, they might know something, but most people who know you now, something they wouldn't know about you. So what do you think? Do you have something you could share?
Yeah, I was the quarterback for the New England Patriots when I was 10. Just joking.
What?
Well, in rock and roll, there's so many things I could tell you that nobody's supposed to know about, but I'm not going there. Okay, so I'm going to play it safe because I could say some things. But anyway, so the thing, this is in the conservative venue. The thing that probably, I'd say, majority of people don't know about me in the rock and roll world, because, you know, I recorded 300 million records sold and, you know, played with everybody, toured with everybody for four decades. And but when I got into rock and roll, I thought it was not cool to tell people that I had a huge education in classical music. I spent 5 years studying classical music, 1 year at University of Massachusetts, 4 years at the number one school of music in the USA, Indiana University. Spent one summer at the Aspen School of Music run by Juilliard. Spent 4 years trying to get into the number one school of music, number one student orchestra in the United States, run by the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Took four consecutive auditions, got in, where I worked with Leonard Bernstein, Aaron Copland, Arthur Fiedler, Seiji Ozawa. Won a concerto competition, which is a violin concerto that I spent 3 hours a day practicing for 365 days, just as one of four pieces on my senior recital at Indiana University. And then my teacher wanted me to audition for a concerto competition. I won, which meant I was the soloist in front of a 60-piece orchestra in a music hall the size of the New York Met. Indiana
wow.
University. In Indiana University's. But it gets bigger than that. Indiana University is so difficult to get into, harder to stay in. It is like being in the Navy SEALs and you're being tested every semester. I would be practicing till 1-2 in the morning till they throw me out of the building. That's just the way you rolled. To be really great at Indiana, you are a bad mofo. Graduated Indiana University and I get into the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra and offered a job in Quito Symphony Orchestra, and I turned them both down. I turned down certainty for a complete uncertainty, which was the rock and roll world. And the bottom line is the reason why I turned down that job, which was certainly a paycheck, a huge success story to go from not being really great reader, not being really adept at timpani and mallets and snare drum and orchestral music, because I grew up playing just rock and roll and jazz and was not part of the music program in high school. But to go from getting into an okay school to then transferring to the number one school, and just from just absolute massive self-discipline, hard work and perseverance, I rose to the top. And and you know, get an orchestra is huge, because there were not that many orchestras. Not to mention, right, my parents paid for my education. And when I turned it down, I was in shock, and so were they. But the reason why I turned it down, and the whole point is that I was following my purpose. My desire what I'm here to do. And it was at age 10 that I saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, and I went, I got to do that. I even told my mom, you got to call the Beatles up and get me in the band. And there was no, I mean, there was no way my mom, she didn't have their number, first of all. Second of all, there was no business model. There was no mentor. Rock and roll had just started. And I grew up in a town of 3,000, so there was no school of rock when it was time to go to college. So I studied classical music. So a lot of people, I don't tell, when I got into rock and roll, I definitely didn't tell people that I had a classical education, because in my mind, that was considered uncool. So
right,
I had this,
would be a detriment to soul.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of like rock and roll people don't read music. And I'm like, not only do I read music, but I'm the most anal chart reader or writer in a that I know of. I write every single note out. I'll be recording 8 songs tomorrow. Everything's written out. Every cymbal crash, every drum beat, every snare, every kick drum, every tom. And that is why I'm able to move from, you know, one band to one TV show to one festival to like on a dime. In 1 week, I could be playing, 80 different songs. It's because I can read and write music very, very proficiently and make it sound like I'm not reading music at all.
Okay, you're right. I was surprised by that, the whole classical training. I love it. And I'm fascinated with particular parts of your story, especially that that first like audition or whatever you did with a rock and roll band. How did you, do you remember, consciously not telling them that you had this experience?
Well, the big audition I had, are you talking about John Cougar Mellencamp?
Was that your first audition into a band, like out of college?
Well, I played in bands out of college. It wasn't really auditions. I mean, people knew. I was always one of the best guys on what I did in the area. So everybody knew me. I knew them. And people always asked me to join their band. So it was never an audition. Mm-hmm. With Mellencamp, that was an audition. And I won it. And 5 weeks later, I mean, I definitely didn't tell him. He knew I lived in Indiana, and probably, I think he probably knew I went to the school of music. But at that point, he knew I was in one of the coolest bands in Bloomington, Indiana. I spent 3 years there trying to make it in a band, write songs, get a record deal, and then go off and tour like the Beatles and make more records and, be on the radio, be on TV. That never happened. So I was going to move to New York at age 27. And I heard about this Johnny Cougar guy, just fired his drummer. I made the right phone calls. I win the audition. And 5 weeks later when, I didn't tell him anything about classical music. These guys didn't read music. It would be, you'd be considered a nerd if you.
Yeah. Well, and I think even worse, it may have intimidated them in a way.
It might have, but either way, I was going to feel the backlash of that because I'm the new guy. I'm green in their world. They could always use that as something like, getting the degree I got, I learned conducting. I had, four semesters of theory and music history, music literature, sight singing, piano. I mean, it was like, that is far from the Rolling Stones and the Beatles as you can get.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, that's what people think. I mean, that's what people think. But as a musician, I can tell you, I disagree. I would say it's as far as you could get. But rock and roll, I mean, depending on what you're talking about, like the Dave Clark Five, they had some solid theory in their
No, I agree with you. And
right?
Absolutely. And Leonard Bernstein used to have a show on TV, and he would compare classical music to rock and roll. And he would actually sit at the piano, and he was joining both worlds together. So absolutely. The difference is that, and you may have touched on that, is that the fact that I could read music and understood theory and all that stuff might make the other people feel like intimidated or like they weren't, whatever. It might make them feel weird in one way. Well, I didn't care.
Judged.
No, the thing
they might feel judged. That's the experience I've had, is that if you work with people that don't have that experience, it's not necessarily that it's intimidated, but they may start to find themselves concerned that they're being judged by somebody who knows more than they
maybe,
do.
Maybe. I know this much, that, you know, I used to take a lot of heat for it in the Mellencamp band because I was educated. See, the thing is, when you learn how to read and write music, you can fall back on that. As soon as someone starts playing, I'm going, and I'm writing this stuff out. Okay, here's a recording session on a record I did this year with Joe Satriani. That record entered the charts at number 8, which is huge, because you're compelling an artist with no vocals competing with Billie Eilish and rap and everything. Entering at number 8 is huge. And but this would be like an example of a chart that I used for a recording session with Joe Satriani.
Oh, wow. I'll share it with the show notes.
And the thing that's cool about that is I can put that up and sight read it. I mean, read it and immediately get, I learned, when I went on tour with Melissa Etheridge, I had to learn a 3-hour show. We only had 9 hours of rehearsal because I was always recording and always busy. So I read the show. And after about, it takes me about 2.5 weeks to finally memorize the show. Now, you have to understand, I was replacing a drummer that already existed. So they were already used to doing this show. So the job was, I come in and I can keep them in business and going, but I'm going to have to read. And when I write down count off segues. When I do shows like the Kennedy Center Honors, I get together with the stage manager, the producer, and the musical director. I know where someone's walking on. I know when to count off. I know who to look at to count off. I know that somebody has to tune their guitars. I know everything. I get the script of the show. It's not just playing drums anymore. You're almost like the musical director's right hand. And if something goes wrong, literally, I mean, it's almost like in the NFL, when they hike the ball, they have the defense has a plan, the offense has a plan. But most situations, they don't go as planned. And your ability to adapt and adjust on a dime and solve problems, that's my job. And so, anyway, Melissa Etheridge turns around and looks at me one night and goes, I can tell when you're reading music and when you're not. And I went, that's not cool. So that elevated me to the next level, which was to step back out of myself and observe myself and say, is that drummer sound like, how does that drummer sound? As if I'm the producer of the band. I'm not even in the band. I'm watching, is that drummer sound like he's reading music, or does he sound like he's in flow?
Feeling the music.
And so this became the next level of observing myself and making sure I don't sound like I'm reading music. And
I want to dig into that a little bit, because that's a really important story. So had you known Melissa Etheridge before you went on tour with her? Did you meet her years before? Okay. So you already had kind of a rapport with her. She already knew she could trust you to show up and do what you say you're going to do. And for her to turn around and make that comment to you, was that on stage during practice or was it actually during
the show?
Oh, holy shit. Okay, so she turns around, she says that to you, and you're like, oh no, that's not right, because I know, just from what I've read about you and some of the conversations I had with Robert, our mutual friend, I know that you're part of why you write the music is so that you can fully, so that you know it well enough to be able to look away. So that must have been kind of a painful moment.
Wasn't painful. It was just in the line of duty. I'd learned at that point, working with so many producers and conductors and having teachers that were, you know, you show up without a pencil and eraser, you're thrown out of his office and you get an F for the day. I was used to so much adversity, and I had learned how to embrace, anything coming at me. Like, for example, firemen, it's not natural to go into a burning house. It's not natural, but you learn. A fireman learns. It's not natural for a person to run into bullets flying at your face, but Marines and Navy SEALs learn. It's right. not natural to jump out of an airplane with a parachute, but you learn.
Well, and, for some, might be.
Yeah, not me.
Though. Well, I guess so, it's more about receiving feedback. It's how you received the feedback.
That absolutely.
You immediately knew exactly what she was talking about.
So, I mean, the feeling is, my thing is that the actual feeling is, oh, shit, am I allowed to swear on this thing?
Absolutely.
Yeah. The feeling is, oh, fuck, I fucked up. So, you know, I work very hard to avoid that. And so those are those moments where you feel like you made a mistake, or it triggers childhood feelings of failure, insecurity, shame. Fucked up. But as an adult, I've learned that, and I truly believe that there are no mistakes, there are no failures. Everything is an experience that leads you to becoming more and more excellent or better at what you do. But the young Kenny, and most people, because when you're little, everybody's big, and you're being told what to do because you're a child, it triggers that feeling of you failed, bad, mistake. You got an F. You should have gotten an A. You right. didn't do your homework right. You're not eating right. Whatever it is. Or you struck out, and we had two people on base, and you lost the game for us. All that stuff is never going to go away. But now when something like that happens, I immediately go into what all the fear and all that energy that somebody would call the fight or fight mode, I turn it into a positive thing where I take that energy to be better at the moment on stage, as opposed to wasting my time dwelling on those old feelings of, oh, you yes. suck, you're yes. a failure, you're a loser. Because it yes. don't focus on the problem, focus on the solution.
Yes, I am so glad you just said that. When so just a little background, I was trained classically. I sang in the Chamber Singers in high school. Like I was in Allstate Choir in Colorado.
Cool.
Junior, senior year. And sang in college, but because I didn't want to be part of that scene, I didn't focus on it, but I sang in choir in college. And then I didn't sing for many years. And I met my husband, and I would stay overnight at his place, and I would wake up to him noodling around on this classical guitar, on acoustic classical guitar.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'd ask him if he could play something that I could sing with. But most of the time, I just listened. And then whenever I was with my sister, one of my close friends that I used to sing with, we would do something in harmony because I'd have ache. Like I just wanted to sing something. I wanted to sing in harmony especially. And it wasn't until we had been married, oh gosh, 10 years or something, that we met this other couple and started a band together. It was really random. It was, we were just doing music nights. And then after 8 weeks of every week doing music nights, we realized we had a set. We had like 12 songs that we could just pull out. So we did this open mic. And all of the people afterward, when we finished, came up, they're like, what's the name of your band? And we're like, oh no, now we have to come up with a band name, because we had never even considered starting a band. It wasn't a thing. So before our first gig, like where we were getting paid and we were opening for another band, and we were called the Perfect Jones, which was a play on addiction, but it was harmony, that Jones thing for that kind of really you can harmonize with somebody, whether that's singing or just in life generally. And I'll never forget this. My husband had found this great article that had a list of six rules for performance, for live performance, for any live performance. But mm-hmm. one of those rules has stuck with me through all of my public speaking, all of the workshops that I've done. One of those rules was, don't agonize over something that went wrong. Just focus on the present moment and make the next moment right. And absolutely. That's exactly what you just said. You just, yeah. if you hold on to it, you agonize over that, you feel that shame and you let that shame take over, the rest of your gig is not going to go well.
No,
because you're not there. You're no longer present. Oh, that's awesome. So I'm sure Melissa didn't say it as an insult.
No.
As much as it was feedback. And so how did you finish the gig? Were you just feeling like, yes, she's listening, like she's paying attention. Sense afterward?
Back then, it was just, I was like, oh, shit. And that's, the rest of the gig, I'm sure I played killer. But the thing is that I definitely, it made me think about it. And I went, the next night, I was like, dude, do not sound like you're reading. Do not sound like you're reading. So it was a great opportunity to learn. So I was grateful because she's a loving person, you know, mm-hmm. so that I didn't feel any bad will towards her. I was just going through my own triggers of failure. Oh my God, you sound, that's not good. It was all about me. I didn't worry about her because she's.
And if anything, you're kind of grateful.
Totally
because
grateful.
Because she said something. If she didn't say something, then you'd never learn that lesson.
No.
And she said it with love. She didn't say it with shame.
She smiled. She turned around, looked at me, and smiled, you know.
Tell the difference. That's awesome. So tell me, you keep coming back to this feeling of shame, of failure. Was there someone, a teacher or someone in your life when you were a kid that that's the image that pops into your head when you think of that sensation, that childhood sensation of feeling shame?
Oh, no, just, to me, I think it's just average stuff, pleasing your parents, pleasing your teachers. You're, like I said, you're small, they're big. They know more than you. And so, you know, you want to please your mom, you want to please your dad. So it was just, I would call normal upbringing and what a child goes through.
I think sometimes, though, it's a particular person.
Well,
for me, it's my brother. Brother was so critical of me, and yet we are really close now. But when I think of that shame of not performing to my potential or doing something that he might not find inspiring or endearing, that's right. I see his face because I just always admired him so much.
Yeah.
And even was getting ready to publish my book. My first thought was, I wonder if my brother's going to like it. Like, is that painful? And it's not him. It's my relationship with him. It's how I see my relationship with him. And that's why I asked you that question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I think that, first of all, I think it's healthy to have that relationship at a very young age so that you can understand it and grow from there. That if you didn't have that, then, I mean, we're here to learn. We're here to in a very short period of time, get the most out of life. And who knows why we're here as humans at this time. But the bottom line is I'm not going to waste my time figuring it out. I just accept it. And part of the learning thing is to work through those type of those type of experiences. So your brother, how much older was he?
2.5 years.
Yeah. Well, for whatever reason, he was that person. I'd say mine was my dad and my mom. I never really thought about it much. My dad, because he was a big, you know, guy and, you know, want to please your dad, if nothing else, so that you get that reinforcement, which feels good when you get it. And the other doesn't feel good. So you go, not just on a simple level, you're going for what feels good. Please your teacher.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, they like you, but you feel good. Basically, what I'm talking about is, as a child, you're looking for validation from everybody. As an adult, you should learn to look for validation from yourself. That's what I learned in the last X number of years. Like, don't look, get the validation from you. You become the player and a coach. And you never get rid of those feelings when you were a child. Those feelings, let's say me looking for validation from people to see if I'm any good, that's the lesson. That's part of the lesson. That tells you, you know, tells me every time I feel that, no. We don't work that way anymore, Kenny. Look for validation. Go in. Are you doing a good job? Yes, I am. All right, there you go. And it's a cool, warm feeling of content that you can have this relationship like player, coach, father, son, in your case, mother, daughter, this thing. And it just, It's a cool feeling. I mean, of course, everybody loves to hear, oh, man, you kicked ass. You know,
right.
You're great, man, you're the best. You
but
know,
you can't but live for that.
You can't live that. Yeah, and it's only normal to feel that. You don't want to go that extreme where, no, don't you dare compliment me.
Yeah. No, I don't think I would ever suffer from that.
Yeah, that'd be another set of problems if you can't yes. accept that. You know,
so, but I have another question that before we wrap up, because this has been just great and very insightful. What keeps you humble? And I ask you that because I feel like I know you now. We've talked on the phone a couple times. We've texted a few times. And of course, through Robert, because Robert and I are close. Through Robert, I feel like I kind of know you. And one of the things that we agreed on during one of our conversations was what humble looks like. Because not everybody agrees with what humble looks like.
Mm.
But one of the things that keeps me humble when I have a great keynote or the release of my book goes well or I have a big gig like on St. Patty's Day, hundreds of people. And then the next day I am in my house cleaning my damn toilet, right? Because I don't have somebody that comes into my house to clean my toilet.
Yeah.
And to me, that's that moment when I am wiping this down, I get out the Comet, I'm like, this is real life. And I think it's part of what keeps me grounded and knowing that I'm nothing special. I mean, I'm special in my own way, just like the janitor is special in his own way or her own way, and the flight attendant is special. And so what is it that after a big gig or after a tour where you have had literally hundreds of thousands of people screaming for you, what is it that you come back to and go, okay, this is real life? That isn't, I mean, it's real, but this is real life.
I have a line that sums it all up. Awesome. I'll never be as great as I want to be, but I'm willing to spend the rest of my life trying to be as great as I can be.
I like that. Is that in your book?
No, it's something I came
Kenny.
Up with. No, I know. I have another book that I wrote. It's probably 2 years old now, and I just put it on the back burner. I got to revisit that book and put a lot of the things I have in my speaking, and I got all kinds of things like that I need to put in there. The book is basically a self-help book. It's basically, you know, are you living your life loud or are you dying on the vine? Because most people are dying on the vine. And I basically say, if you do nothing, you get nothing. And if you're waiting, nobody's born successful. If you're waiting for shit to land in your lap or you're waiting for it to come to you, I'm the guy who's going to take it from you. Not purposefully, but if you're waiting for something, I'm going to come whipping by and I see it. I'm going for it, you know?
Right.
Anyway, though, what I'm basically saying is, an example is a running back in the NFL, one of the most powerful athletes, you know, on the planet. Do they get touchdowns every time they get the ball? Hell no. Most of the time they don't. But they spend their entire career trying to get in the end zone. And they are focused. And do they make mistakes? Hell yes. They get their legs and fingers and arms and ribs broken? Hell yes. They have trained themselves to focus on their goal, and they are humbled every day by things they could have done better. And so when I perform, people may dig what I'm doing. My bosses may dig what I'm doing, but I know what I did and I know how I can play better. That's not to say that I'm a failure at all. It's just that I am aware that I can always do better, and that's what keeps me hungry and humble.
I love that. Tell me that line again.
I'll never be as great as I want to be, but I'm willing to spend the rest of my life trying to be as great as I can be.
Yeah. Because that gives you an opportunity every day to start over. You fuck up one day, the next day you get to start over and try again.
You can even fuck up and in 2 seconds you can redeem yourself.
Yes, exactly. Like on stage. That's a great analogy.
Exactly.
That is a great analogy. Yeah.
Unlike somebody is my twin brother who's a psychoanalyst. He said, God, Kenny, you make a mistake, you can redeem yourself in a second. I have two papers I have to write in one semester. I mess up one, I have to wait to write the next one to redeem myself. I have to wait 2 months.
Right. Well, there are some careers that are like that, but I think in life generally, we all have those opportunities. If we cut somebody off in traffic accidentally and we're like, oh, sorry, the next time we go to turn left, we're going to pay more attention. Or we can, and we can redeem ourselves from that error in judgment of not paying attention. Yeah.
Yeah, you just become more aware. Another way to look at it, you become more aware, and so the next time you purposely cut that person off and give them the finger. And then either way, you're very aware.
Right. I call that, no, seriously, I call that intention. It's all about intention for me. If you are unintentionally an asshole, then you're dealing with all kinds of consequences without even knowing it.
Yeah.
If you're intentionally an asshole, then you're dealing with the consequences. Okay, well, I know I'm an asshole, and that's why these people treat me like crap.
You own
it. Or that's why I don't have great relationships. Yeah, exactly. You got to own it. You got to be intentional about it. He said next time and flip them. Anyway, so we can move on from this. But that's exactly right. So I just have to ask you before you wrap it up. You said you're from the East Coast, and this is something I wanted to just ask a little bit about because I could hear a little bit of your accent. Where did you actually grow up?
Well, what you might be hearing is my New York accent, but I'm not from New York. My parents. My mom was from the Bronx. My dad was from just over the bridge in Jersey, but moved to New York. But I was raised in a very, very beautiful, unique little New England town called Stockbridge, Massachusetts. And I mean, I tell the story in my book. I mean, literally, if I walk a quarter of a mile, you couldn't see anybody's houses because it was all woods and we were in the hills. And the first house on my left was Norman Mailer's house. And you walk.
Awesome.
That was an eighth of a mile. Another eighth of a mile was where Patty Hearst's family lived, you know, at one point. Mm-hmm. And then you go down the hill and there's a water wheel, an old cottage where this famous actress, Eleanor Wilson, lived. And I used to be her gardener at 25 cents an hour. Then right across the street, a little ways down, was Reinhold Niebuhr. And he was either a Harvard or a Yale graduate, and he created the Serenity Speech, and he is a very spiritual man, published many times. The bottom of the hill right there was a Berkshire Theater Festival, and that's where the summer stock, people from New York would come and act. I met Richard Dreyfuss, Goldie Hawn, I mean, Frank Langella, all these people, and I actually was in a performance there once in a small little theater. Then you go down through Main Street of Stockbridge. And this town is where Alice's Restaurant happened. This is where Arlo Guthrie lived. This is where the whole hippie thing happened. Also, this is the town, and I used to go to Norman Rockwell's house, one of the greatest American illustrators who did the covers of the Post and Saturday Evening Post, I think. Anyway, I mean, and then Sigmund Freud's protege lived in Stockbridge. We had a famous, really famous, very exclusive kind of, we called it mental hospital, but a hospital to take care of people that were like trying to get off of alcohol, drugs. It was an expensive one. I mean, the building looked like it was somebody's mansion. It was very exclusive, but it was, I played in a band once for their New Year's Eve party, and somebody suggested I let somebody sit in with the band, and I went, no. What do they play? Acoustic guitar? Nah. I'm playing, we got this R&B rock band. Nah. And they said, no, but that guy's got a record deal on Apple Records. I went, what's Apple Records? It was James Taylor.
Oh.
Completely blew him off. But, you know, that town was my best friend's dad. I'd play at his house every weekend. Was Tommy Gibson. His dad wrote The Miracle Worker, the Helen Keller story. Mm-hmm. And his friend was a director, Arthur Penner, who did Bonnie and Clyde and Little Big Man. And he had a house up there. And I was at their house one day. I was 13, and there's Faye Dunaway, Frank Langella, Anne Bancroft, Mel Brooks. I mean, this town was like...
What brought your family there? Because were they into art and...
No. Actually, okay, that's a good question. So this town was very unique, but there were a lot of little mill towns because there was a river that came down from Vermont called the Housatonic River, and they had paper mills on these towns. Right. So the town, there was a town 3 miles from our house called Lee, Mass, and they had a big paper mill there. My dad was a chemist and was a paper expert, so he worked there. And another town next to us was Great Barrington. The river worked its way there. They had a mill there. Housatonic was 1 mile from Great Barrington. Another mill there. And that's what
so your dad was a chemist.
Chemist, paper expert, and eventually a salesman working for a division of Kimberly-Clark.
Oh, you know, those names are all familiar to me. My dad was in the printing and publishing industry. That was that side of the family was all printing and publishing. And so
paper.
Some of those names, I'm like, oh, that sounds really familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah, paper was big.
You know, the town I grew up in, people left their keys in the cars. We never locked the doors. It was our house was open to people 24 hours a day. We didn't know that. I didn't even pay attention to, you know, black, white, yellow, what religion, you know, it's just everybody got along. It was like a utopia, you know.
Was it diverse? Because most of the names you mentioned, they've all been white.
No, there was this one of my best friends was Skip Gunn, and he was a black man. He was our soccer goalie. We used to hang out with him. I mean, he was like the coolest guy. And Harry Smith was a black guy who was our lead singer in our band. It was like, I just didn't think about it. If anything,
right.
I was the one that was considered weird because there was only two Jewish kids in my school. One was my brother. And in second grade, I remember the kids went, "You killed Christ." And I went home crying to my dad. So I went home. Well, they all were going to catechism and after school.
Right.
And I was like, huh? And so I went home and told my dad, and he told me a lot of things, but one of the things he told me was that, well, actually Jesus was Jewish before they created Christianity. I went back to school and went, Jesus was a Jew. Bam.
Oh.
I got beat up. And so I come home and my dad says, What did you tell them? I said, Jesus was a Jew. And he goes, that's not the only thing I told you. But as a little kid, I wanted to get back at them. Anyway, it's all good.
No, that's hilarious. And it's familiar because we're raising our children in Helena, Montana. And when we moved here 21 years ago with a 6-month-old baby, it wasn't diverse. And it's still not diverse. I mean, and that's one of the things my younger son said, I kind of regret growing up in a place with so little diversity. And I said, well, that's why we traveled. That's why we spent a week in Paris. It's why you spent a week with my sister near Detroit and in San Francisco was so that you would live and be exposed to a variety of people. Because, I mean, that's something we've talked a lot about is anti-Semitism and racism. Because we are one of the very few Jewish families in this town. And my kids had very similar experiences. One kid was absolutely sure that the Jews killed Jesus. And I went in to do a Hanukkah presentation. And he said it to me. And I said, no, it was the Romans, Christopher. Get your history right.
Yeah,
right. And he got very quiet. And he never said another word about it. That was second grade.
Yeah.
But it's crazy. Where do they learn that?
Well, I think that... you know, not to get into too much, I think that you're seeing a lot right now because everybody's been so trapped in because of the COVID thing that it's a crucible of frustration. You had some mental illness, some drug and alcohol problems, and you've created a combustible bomb. And so all you need is one little thing for people to vent their anger and frustration, and that's part of why everything is so big and blown up right now.
Yeah.
But you know, no excuse, but that just like added gasoline to the fire pretty much.
Yeah.
It just
totally
is what it is.
Totally
and, you know, we'll get through it. I mean, you know, listen, people, you know, in history some crazy shit has gone down. I mean, I'm reading a Winston Churchill book who's one of my heroes. I mean, they bombed London For 4 years, they bombed the crap out of London. Every day, those people would go under. You know, I'm talking like, you know, because Hitler and the Nazis had a massive, you know, military. And until the Americans got involved, that Hitler diverted. They all kind of played it cool at first. We're going to blow out your industries. We're going to blow out your shipyards. And then when Hitler saw that he couldn't do what he did, he decided, we're going to terrorize you. The people. We are going to blow them up. And those people dealt with that for 4 years, not 2 months, not 3 months. You know, there's all kinds of stories like this. We're just living through a huge historical moment right now that is global. It's like a World War III, but it's with a virus. And then you add all these other, tensions with, you know, prejudice and, you know, people, you know.
Politics and media.
And frustrations.
Our access to ridiculous amount of information and maybe 10% of it is accurate.
Well, you know, yeah.
Yeah, let's not go there. This has it's been such a long conversation.
Oh, this TV station. On one TV station says it's green. The other TV station says it's red. You guys are supposed to be reporting the truth. How can you be so completely opposite?
Yeah, I know. It's crazy.
So anyway, I was in a big global kind of positive thing with Maxi Priest, a black artist from Jamaica, a gypsum, a black artist from Jamaica, another person in New York, and the whole idea was to, you know, in these times, talk about something positive. Here's what I said. Mm-hmm. You know, the best thing I can do, and the thing I do is I go to my studio every day and I play the drums and I record music and I do podcasts and Zooms, and it makes me so happy, and that everybody I come in contact with, there's the ripple effect of my joy, positiveness, happiness that goes into them. And that is the most that any individual can do by just being, you know, taking care of themselves, being as happy and as positive as you can. And everybody you run into, you influence them with that beautiful vibe. And that's the best anybody can do, you know, at least a great starting point.
Totally agree. Share the love, share the kindness.
Yeah, I mean,
be there, be
make
present.
Sure you take care of yourself and feel love within yourself so that you can give it to other people.
Right, absolutely. I actually just said that with a friend. I said, I think part of the reason so many people are so angry is that they're dissatisfied with their own lives.
Of course.
They haven't taken on that responsibility to find satisfaction in their own lives. And so it's so much easier to blame outside forces.
Exactly,
for
sure.
So you're right. Taking care of yourself is the key. And loving yourself and finding ways to find satisfaction and happiness.
Yeah.
Well, that is a great place to wrap this up. This was so wonderful.
Cool.
Just for our listeners, tell me the name of your book that was published recently.
Well, this is not recently, but I happen to have it because I've got to do a test run. They started doing an audio version of this book and with somebody else doing it. I'm like, dude, I should read my own book. But this
that's ironic.
Book, and this is, and actually our friend, Robert Downs took the cover. He did the cover of it. Sex Drums, Rock and Roll. And I think there's a picture in here of me and Leonard Bernstein. Oh, there's a great picture of me and Melissa. Can you see?
Oh, yes, I love that. All right, we're going to have to do a screenshot of that so we can include it in the show notes. Yeah. So Sex, Drugs, Rock and Roll, and
drums,
of course. How could I even say that wrong?
No, that's all right. That's all right. I love that phrase.
Yes, of course. I will have a link to purchase that book on the blog post associated with the podcast. I will also have some screenshots of your music notes that you showed me earlier on, and then maybe a screenshot of that page of the book with Melissa Etheridge, because you had told me the story already.
Yeah.
So our listeners will have some context for that photo. That'll be awesome. And if people want to get in touch with you and learn more about what you do, what's the best way to do that?
Well, first of all, You can get in touch with me on my website, and I have a recording studio where I'm right now, Uncommon Studios LA. People fill out forms to either, you can have me to play on your records and your music, but they also can reach out to me that way. There's a email address there. Just go on my website, and you'll see an email address, or, you know, I'm on Twitter, Official Aronoff, Facebook. If I don't add you, I've got like 2,000 people waiting to be added. I mean, I tapped out 8 years ago. But I have a fan page, Facebook, and a personal Facebook. I have Instagram, and I'm on LinkedIn too, and I have a YouTube channel. Yeah, you can find me.
Great. Well, I'll have some links on the podcast notes on that blog post associated with this podcast.
I can send that to you too.
That would be great. Kenny, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. Your stories don't define you. How you tell them will.
Thank you so much, man. Have a great time.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Your Stories Don't Define You, How You Tell Them Will. If you're planning an event or company retreat and want to bring in a memorable, entertaining, and highly practical speaker as your keynote speaker or workshop facilitator, please visit us at elkinsconsulting.com. to learn how we can help and provide a memorable keynote or breakout session. Thank you. I look forward to hearing from you.
Now listen to me.